Good evening, everyone. Good evening. You've tuned into Paradigm Shifters, and our Paradigm Shifter tonight is quite a character and has been shifting the paradigm with consciousness in the oddest weaving of interesting expressions of the last, 50 years that I've experienced, and I love it. And welcome to the show, Brad Warner, and your new book, There Is No God, and He's Always With You. I love that title. So welcome to the show.
You. Thank you. Glad to be here.
It's going to be fun, I think, because I love the stuff I've read about you, even online and so on. And you have a rather unique approach to what we say would be enlightenment or spiritual practice or Buddhism. You want to explain a little bit about your history and how you got into all that?
Oh, golly. The thing people seem to most focus on about my history is the fact that I started off, I got into Zen when I was in I was a bass player for a punk rock band called Zero Defects, a hardcore punk band, and I found a lot of affinity between the Zen approach and the punk approach because we were both trying to get at something more true and more real. And I was a little disappointed by the punk rock scene because I thought it sort of, they didn't take it far enough. They would just kind of, they would dress and talk the talk, but they wouldn't really go as far as they ought to. And I felt that in a lot of ways, Zen was the most punk rock thing I'd ever come across. So I kind of dived into it. And I became a teacher kind of accidentally because I did it. I found this practice, the Zazen, the meditation practice, to be really, really useful in my life. And I just took it up and I moved to Japan having nothing to do really with Zen, but more to get a job. I already had a Zen teacher in the U.S., but I met a teacher over there because I wanted to continue what I was doing. And he was the one who sort of, he more than encouraged me to become a teacher. He sort of forced it upon me. It's kind of a hard story to explain, but he kept giving me more and more duties around his group until he finally made me the head of his group. And it was just like, I don't really want to be the head of your group. I just want to sit here and meditate and kind of ask a question every once in a while. But and so, and I wrote a book about that process more, and this was another sort of accidental thing. I was trying to be a novelist, and I'd written several novels that I couldn't get published. And then as a sort of an act of desperation or just finding something else to write about, I wrote this sort of autobiographical book about my experiences in Zen. Looked at it when it was finished and thought, this is punk rock, this is monster movies, because I was working for a company that made monster movies.
In Japan?
In Japan, yeah. And I thought, nobody's going to read a book about punk rock monster movies and Zen. And much to my surprise, after getting rejected with, four different novels that I thought were fairly commercial, I sent this thing out and somebody wanted to publish it. It just floored me. I had no idea anybody would want to publish something like that.
Well, hang on. I can't let you go past without this question is, how does Zen or punk rock both head you into a better relationship to reality? How does that work?
Well, the reason I got into the punk rock means a lot of things to a lot of people, but the reason I got into it was because to me it meant an approach to something I dearly valued, which was music, that was what was direct and real. It was stripping away all the pretensions and just trying to get at the core of what rock music was supposed to be about. And it was very truthful. The group of people that I was in cahoots with, or whatever you say, back in Akron, Ohio, when I started, were very committed to this kind of, strange morality. I mean, I say strange because it wasn't based on religion or anything like that, but it was based on this sense that moral action was crucial. And you don't find, groups of young people committed to moral action unless they're religious people, very often. And I was really inspired by that. So I got into it for that. I just felt like it didn't really take it all the way. Whereas Zen also, I was into this idea of stripping away and getting at the truth, but they were more, it seemed to me, able to get at the truth within themselves too, without just settling on, well, this, you know, looking like we are opposed to general society is enough. It was more like you had to really live it. And so that,
you had to be it, right?
Yeah, yeah. And that's what attracted me to it. And also the meditation practice was sensible. I'd tried some kinds of meditation before, and they all seemed to be very goal-oriented. And it appeared to me that being goal-oriented was the problem. Whereas Zen has this very weird idea that that there is no goal, and good teachers will keep hammering that in over and over, and it's very hard to deal with because you're always making some sort of an objective. But what you need to do is stop making any objectives, which is.
You mean like enlightenment or...
Enlightenment or being a good person or mindfulness or any of those things. You just stop wanting any of them and just sit with what you are. And
what you are deepens, would you say? Is it just like a deepening process that goes on your whole life sort of thing?
Yeah, yeah. It deepens and just seeing... Being very, very quiet and facing the truth of what you are is enlightening in itself, because you find all sorts of things that, you know, you might not really want to find, and then you
have
to
go. The truth of self, eh?
Yeah, and then you have to go, well, what am I going to do about this? You know, there's obviously something. You'll see your problems in a very clear way. And then you kind of feel obligated to act on them, because they just present themselves to you so clearly that it's hard to ignore.
So you changed your whole life that way. I want to go back to something I read right at the beginning of this amazingly wonderful book, actually. It's so good. Was about, I just hooted with laughter, because one of the things, having been on the spiritual path or a spiritual path for a long time, the thing that bugs me the most in myself and everyone else is the competition or the separation on who's the most of this or, you know, there's all this separative stuff. And then when you were talking, tell people about the monster movie section. I loved that, where you're talking about how... people were in the same kind of putting each other in corners and competition.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah. Of course, yeah. It's like
I actually laughed right out loud. I was howling.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it was a funny thing to see that people were doing precisely the same thing. There's this sort of nerd world stuff that occurs anytime you have... in any group of people who are interested in something that the overall society is not interested in. And so I worked for a company founded by the guy who basically invented Godzilla, and I love those Godzilla movies and things. And Godzilla nerds are the worst, because nobody, you know, you can have an anime convention or the comic book convention, but something as niche as Godzilla is really, really getting deep into that area. And I saw people within the Zen world behaving exactly the same way as people in that Godzilla fan world, because they're all trying to outdo each other.
I love that.
In the depth of their nerdiness, but that doesn't help anything.
Well, I think you said they were in like little wars against which of the monsters. Was that it? Godzilla against...
Yeah, whether Godzilla has four toes or three. I mean, that was something I actually heard people get really heated about, you know. And it's just like, really? Come on.
Well, let's go back to your meditation. Did you did it release you for, you know, greater awareness, greater writing, greater, what, creative expression?
Yeah, I think so. You know, it's a kind of a weird thing to use it for the purpose of
of making that kind of thing happen. You know, I just read this article about Buddhism is meditation is not a productivity booster or something. I think that was the title of the piece, and the person was saying, really, you can boost your productivity. Meditation can be part of that, but you don't really use it as a tool to boost productivity. That would be, he said, like using your car as a greenhouse. You know, I mean, you could use your car as a greenhouse, but it would be a kind of a waste of everything that the car can do.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's the same kind of thing. But yeah, it for me, it was it's been good. I do my Zazen practice every morning, and it kind of makes me. I don't know, it does all these wonderful things, although I don't like to claim too much of it, because in a way you sort of jinx it by claiming too much of it.
Yeah, I understand.
But I, you know, it's been good. It's kind of opened up a lot of these little areas in my body and mind that I didn't even realize were there. So yeah, it's been good for that.
So God, let's talk about God. Not Godzilla, but God.
Yeah.
So I guess I really, I just smile. I figure that there's, well, can you explain something about how you experience God then, whatever that means? Because you're saying he never leaves you, you know?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I decided to kind of use this word God to describe what I thought Zen was getting into. And I did a talk at Atasahara, which is a Zen monastery up in Northern California.
It's a great
and I did this
recipe book.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, they do great bread.
Mm-hmm.
But I did this talk, and it was about God. And right after, one of the kind of people who runs Atasahara came up to me, and she said that she thought it was very brave of me to put it in those terms. And I'd never thought about it as brave, but now that I've put a book out on the subject, I understand why she said that, because people get very heated up about this word God, and I think they should. You know, it's been abused for so long, and I don't believe in a God that belongs to a certain religion and has a, you know, particular likes and dislikes and if you don't believe in him, you'll go to hell and all this stuff. I think that's nonsense. But I think a lot of times Zen practices is presented as being a religion without God is sometimes how it's put. And I think in a sense you can say that. It doesn't have an object of worship like most religions do.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, to say it's without God, I think is also selling it short, because it is dealing with these big questions. And the way our Western society has for the past maybe 5,000 years dealt with the big questions is by talking in terms of God. And of course, this gets abused because you say God and then say, okay, well, God must be, and then you try to make a box around God. He must like this and dislike that. He must be a man and not a woman. You know, he must live in, you know, over there in that corner of the universe and not this corner of the universe, and so on and so forth. But to limit God in that way is ridiculous, because we're talking about everything. And I think it's also ridiculous to, you know, there's that kind of materialistic view that takes the idea that there is no God, meaning that the universe is just a collection of dead matter that happens to interact. And once you get to a certain level of complexity, this dead matter imagines that it's alive, but that's not really true. It's not alive. You know, I think that's kind of nonsensical as well. I think life and God and the universe are all kind of a continuum, and I think it's not wrong to talk in terms of God sometimes, because there is something, and I feel that in my practice I've encountered it, that much bigger than us, that really could be called God, except you can't limit it in the way that God is usually limited, because it's not male, it's not female, it's not in one place as opposed to another. To say it's good as opposed to non-good is also limiting it.
Is it creating report cards for us all?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I don't think God is up there worried about what we think and what we don't think. I never could understand this obsession that a lot of religions have in belief. You know, it's like they're presenting God as the ultimate creative force in the universe, and then, okay, I follow you that far, but then the ultimate creative force in the universe hides it somewhere where we can't find him, and then gets really mad that we don't believe in him when he hasn't really given us any reason to believe in him in the first place. And I just think that's an absurd thing. You're positing this really absurd creature who writes a book and then says, okay, you got to believe what's in this book. And I'm not going to give you any reason to believe what's in the book, but if you don't believe what's in the book, I'll send you to hell. That makes no sense.
He'd be a good stand-up comic, I think. You know.
Yeah.
Well, so it seems to me as you got into this, you've traveled, you've lived in different countries as a young man, right?
Yeah. I lived in Africa as a child and then Japan for a long time, too.
That must have infused a lot of your thinking with these different philosophical, or awareness of different philosophical approaches, eh?
Yeah, I think so. I was born and raised for the first, I don't know, 7 years of my life in rural Ohio, and then just kind of ripped out of that at age, I don't know, seven or so. Was how old I was when we moved to Nairobi. Mm. And I think that really changed my outlook. I mean, I was open to it. You know, you tell a seven-year-old boy that he's going to go to Africa, he's like, oh, yeah, Africa, great, you know. Tarzan, you know, all that you just think of.
Yeah.
But I did not see Tarzan. But it was great to live in this very, very different society from the one I'd started off my life in, and just to see, okay, there are ways of life that are radically different from what I'm used to, and that doesn't necessarily mean they're evil or stupid or, you know, any of that, or primitive. You know, you start to, you know, these sort of ideas stop making sense. You know, like I grew up in rural Ohio, we would see Amish people, and then I went to Africa and I saw the Maasai, and instead of the Maasai looking like these, to me, like these, you know, weird, stuck in the primitive people, I thought, okay, here are these people who have a choice whether to accept the modern world or not, and like the Amish, they've rejected it.
Hmm.
And I thought that was really interesting, and it's not the way people usually don't, for example, draw a connection between Amish and Maasai. I never heard anybody say that. But just that experience led me to think that it introduced me to other religions, too, because I'd grown up thinking religion equals Protestant Christianity. You know, that's mm-hmm. all I was exposed to. Mm-hmm. And then to be in a place where actually, Protestant Christianity is probably the majority religion in Kenya, but there are also Muslims and there are Hindus and there are a few Buddhists, and to go, oh wow, there's all sorts of ideas.
Did you experience a little taste of all those different situations as you grew up?
Yeah, a bit. My dad's closest friend, or one of his closest friends, was an Indian man, and I remember being very fascinated that he wasn't a vegetarian, but his wife was a vegetarian, and we'd go to their house, and there were these pictures of these four-armed blue people, you know, and I'd say, well, what is that a picture of? And he'd say, well, that's a picture of God. And I'm like, whoa, I never thought of God as being a four-armed blue creature stepping on the head of a snake, you know, and it was very interesting to see all of this.
So you'd have kind of an open appreciation without too much prejudice, eh?
Yeah, I think so, because, you know, you couldn't You know, if I'd stayed in Ohio, I don't know the type of person I am. I don't know what direction I would have gone. But you know, that's the kind of place where you could develop these prejudices and these ideas that that you're better than them or whatever. But when you go to a place where the majority of people are a different color from you and a different and have a radically different way of life, you have to say, okay, well, who's right? You know, does the way we live back in Ohio make any more sense than the way they live here? You know,
yeah, you're kind of imbued with a spiritual, a universal thing, isn't that right? When you travel like that as a youth.
Yeah, I think so, and I think it was it's something I'm really grateful for. And then in recent years, I keep getting invited to talk in strange, exotic, foreign countries. You know, I haven't been invited to Africa yet, but I've done a few tours of Europe, and I'm going out again in October for another one. And just to see that, you know, there's so much if you live in one country that you take for granted, and then if you're thrust into another society, it makes everything change, you know, including your approach to something like God.
So you can't be rigid, is that what you're saying, Brad?
Yeah, you can't be because even in terms of survival, you won't survive that kind of upbringing or that kind of travel if you're too rigid in your ways of thinking, because you just, you know, you won't be able to eat or sleep or, you know, do any of the basic things if you just continuously refuse to accept what other people are doing.
And so I flipped the book open just now, and it's chapter 10, and it's called In Which I Discover the True Meaning of Faith by Going to Finland. You want to tell us about going to Finland?
Well, Finland was an interesting one because I've been there three times, and it was something I didn't expect. It came up that the publishers of my first book, came to me and said, "Oh, we've sold the foreign language rights," and I'm thinking, "Okay, maybe France or Spain or something like that," and it turns out to be Finland, and I'm like, "Finland? You know, of all places, I'd never even really thought about Finland." But I went there at the invitation of a guy who's a big fan of my writing, and he arranged a tour, and it was really interesting because Finland is they don't approach life in the same way as we do. You know, they have this weird seasonal thing that affects everything. You know, whereas we sort of think of seasons. Especially, I moved to California a few years ago, and there's no seasons at all. But even back in Ohio, it's just sort of something you deal with. But in Finland, it structures your whole life. You know, it has to be structured around the seasons. So you have this kind of
dark some part of the year, hey?
Yeah. It's completely dark all winter, and then it's completely bright all summer. And people there are just now starting to experience Buddhism. It hasn't really, it's Buddhism has had a funny history. I think the West is going to be the next place where Buddhism becomes a major force. Hmm. You know, it started off in India, moved into China, moved into Korea and Japan, and then from there leapt across the Pacific. You know, first hitting California and places on the west coast of the United States.
Doesn't everything hit California first?
Well, I don't. Yeah, some of it. Yeah, but then it's been gradually filtering from America into Europe. I mean, there've been some direct. There's been like this guy Deshimaru came over to France and stuff. But most of what they're getting of Buddhism is being filtered through America. I mean, there might be some European listeners who would argue that, but I think it's very true in a lot of ways that it's coming through this culture. It's being kind of filtered through us.
Do you think the Dalai Lama is seeding it a lot too?
The Dalai Lama has been doing that. You know, he's touring around the world, and he's spent a great deal of time in the United States. And then, you know, from there launching off into Europe and places. So it's interesting to see how this is going.
Well, also you mentioned in your book about how in the old Buddhism, they used to have like six levels of afterlife, and it was kind of scary, a little bit scary.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're saying they're not carrying that particular tradition with them. Do you want to talk a bit about that?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of things that are changing about Buddhism, particularly like the six realms. There's a chant we do if you go to any Zen temple before a meal, where you dedicate your meal to the beings in the six realms. And I can never remember. It's like heavens, hells, the hungry ghosts, the demons, the animals. I forget how it works.
I know they're a bit scary.
Yeah, yeah. And we're losing a lot of that because we have developed different ways of dealing with those same human things. We deal in psychological things. I remember my Japanese teacher saying that we didn't really have to worry about those six realms and things like that. They're just descriptions of the same things that Western people are describing in terms of psychology. You know, you'll talk about psychosis or schizophrenia and these kind of words we have to talk about people who are in extreme states of body and mind disorientation. That might be a way to put it. And so we recognize that there are all these kind of levels of human and non-human experience that some of us are lucky enough to exist in a level that's relatively stable. Mm-hmm. And we don't have to say that, okay, this is it exists on, I don't know, 5,000 feet below the ground, and there's flames, and there's, you know, a guy in a red suit and all that. You know, you don't have to go into that sort of level of belief. You can see it all around you. You know, I live in Los Angeles, and if I walk down the street in certain parts of town, you know, Hollywood, I'll find people who are living in the realm of hungry ghosts and the realm of fighting demons, and, you know, it's not that these are other places or planets or something crazy like that. And so that's the way we experience these things.
So I guess I was thinking that it means that it's more acceptable and more modernized. What I mean is do you see what I mean? It doesn't seem to corral people into the old fear-based stuff as much as the old stuff did.
Well, yeah. I mean, fear is just one of the things you're dealing with in the practice. So yeah, the idea of sort of scaring people into behaving correctly, you know, I don't know. I think maybe there might have been a time in human society where that worked. You know, the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. I think it's in the Old Testament somewhere. Mm-hmm. But that might have worked, but we can't, you know, we've come too far. I think there might be individuals among us who do fear God in that way still, but as a collective thing, it's not possible because we know too much about how things work to sit around quaking in fear at this, you know, giant granddaddy in the sky. And people who are trying to revive that as a way to fix the ills of human society, I think are really going in the wrong direction because, you know,
well, how do they approach death?
How does
it all approach death?
Death. Oh boy. Yeah, that's a
small
tough
subject,
one.
Eh?
Yeah. I mean, it's a tough one because it's something, you know, we are all aware that we're all going to die, you know. Lately the thing that people like to talk about is the singularity, and you know, we're within the next 30 years or something, we're supposed to be able to transfer ourselves completely over into machines and live forever. I've heard people say that, and people are getting excited about that. Like, oh, maybe we'll, you know, maybe we're the generation who's going to live forever. But I doubt that that's going to happen. You know, I think the same thing is going to be true. That's always been true in human kind's history, is that we're all doomed, you know, but that doesn't have to be a horrible thing because that's just a change in things. And what, you know, Buddhism is kind of famous for
Well, depending on who you listen to, I was going to say it's kind of famous for not positing too much about what happens after you die. Although, if you listen to certain Buddhists, they'll tell you a lot of details about what they think happens after you die.
A lot of the bardo information.
Right. Yeah. Right. Right. But if you actually go to the original source stuff, when Buddha himself was asked these questions, he set, I think, a great example by saying it doesn't fit the case. You're asking the wrong question. So he was not a person who went into, you know, that stuff about the bardos and stuff. That all came later. When Buddha himself was asked these kind of questions, he didn't elaborate on this sort of mechanism of what happens after you die. He just said, this doesn't fit the case. This is not a question that leads to the end of suffering. We need to be more concerned with this life. And if there is an afterlife, the afterlife will take care of itself. You know, all suppositions about the afterlife, whether you believe in it or not, but they all are based on the idea that behaving in the correct way now will have good results. You know, the Christian ideas of the afterlife also have that idea, and so do the Hindu ones. And as far as Buddhism is concerned, you know, it's pointless to really worry too much about what happens after you die. Just do the right thing at this moment, and if there's an afterlife, you'll be fine. You know, and if there's no afterlife, you'll have a good life here.
You won't even notice.
Yeah, you won't even notice. So what's the point?
I think that's so interesting. I mean, that's probably a thing that's discussed throughout any spiritual focus, isn't it? It's just fascinating because I guess we don't really know anyway.
Yeah, we don't. I mean, there's people who claim, you go to the supermarkets these days and there's a whole genre of books now because one person published a really successful book. His little kid apparently had a near-death experience and then went to heaven, and then he published a book about it, and now there's like a dozen of these.
I'm a lot more than that probably, hey?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And these people who claim that they've experienced the afterlife, but they're all alive. So I can't really believe that. I mean, not at least at taking it at face value. Mm-hmm. So you
seem to be holding yourself free of attaching to anything that keeps I know what you called it in here, the Uh-oh. Porn of enlightenment.
yeah,
please use that. I love that expression. I really hooted with that.
Well, it's something, I guess other people have said this, but I had a friend, Jim Millar, used to talk, he was a guitar, I play guitar too, and he's a guitar player, and he'd talk about guitar porn, you know, these magazines with these great glossy pictures of guitars that you just salivate over, like as if they're porn. And I feel the same thing is, you know, it can be applied to a lot of things, including enlightenment. So there's loads of books and things out there in which enlightenment is presented in a kind of pornographic fashion. Like, here it is. Doesn't it look really juicy? Don't you want that enlightenment? You know, it looks like fun, doesn't it?
You'll live in ecstasy.
Yeah, yeah. And it's usually some guy presenting his grand awakening experience in great detail and saying, you know, here I've come from this experience. You know, and I wrote about my own experiences along those lines in this book and in my first book, Hardcore Zen, to try to dispel some of that. I mean, those experiences do exist, and I think they're real, and I think they have value, and I think maybe life might be better if more people had that. But on the other token, on the other hand, whatever, you need to be careful about experiences like that, because if you go into that unprepared, then it's basically the same as having a psychotic experience. You know, it can kind of make you crazy. So that's why in Zen practice, we emphasize all this sort of moral action and very slow, gentle easing into the experience, so that it takes years before you actually have any kind of so-called enlightenment experience, so that by the time you have it, you understand some of what that experience shows you, because it can just, you know, because if you have it before you're ready, it just shows you a lot of things you can't understand, and then you're liable to make a mess of it rather than making it something wonderful.
Well, you could make a misinterpretation, I suppose, eh?
Yeah, you could say, oh, I'm enlightened. You know, my favorite story is Shoko Asahara, who is this guy who put the poison gas on the Tokyo subway systems in, was it 1995? And I was there, and I was riding those trains the day that happened, luckily on a different line from the one that actually got attacked.
Wow.
But so that was a big moment in my life. But he had claimed to have enlightenment experiences, but he never had anybody to help him deal with those experiences. So he thought it made him invincible and godlike, and that every decision he made, including a decision to put poison gas on the subway systems, had to be right because he was now privy to some sort of godlike experience. Mm. Whereas if he'd had somebody, a proper teacher, who had also gone through those experiences herself or himself, Asahara would have been able to get a bit of grounding in that. Mm. So it's important to be grounded in these experiences.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Well, I want to ask you about your personal journey, but we didn't finish going to Finland, so I feel like I've everybody hanging on that one.
Well, the specific thing I wrote about in the book in Finland was a guy who was a Finnish professor of Buddhism I encountered, who was he talked a lot about afterlives, and he talked about how he looked like a rabbi because he was Jewish in a past life and he wasn't Jewish in this life and all this stuff. But there was a lot of stuff in there about faith, and that word faith has always been very difficult for me, because it tends to mean believing things you can't yourself prove. But it turns out, I did a bit of research on the origins of the word faith and belief in English, and it turns out it was 17th century before the word believe started to mean what it means now, which is to believe that some sort of abstract theory is true without you yourself knowing it. And when the Bible was actually written and used words like faith and belief, they meant trust, you know, like, I believe in you. You know, you might say to your spouse, you know, if your spouse says, I wasn't with that woman. I was just taking her to a business lunch, you know, and you'd say, I believe in you, you know, which is, I have faith and I have trust in you. But the idea of the word belief meaning, the Bible says that there was a flood over the world and we must believe that actually happened. That's a later interpretation created by scientists who wanted to use a word to refer to theories that they hadn't actually tested for themselves. So they started to use the word belief in that way. And so to read that back into the Bible is to completely misconstrue what the Bible is saying about belief. I found that fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Most religions have that kind of, or most political doctrines, all kinds of doctrines have that problem, don't they? You really have to get in there to the etymology of the word, right?
Well, yeah, and you know, there's an old Zen saying that the word is not the thing, you know, that words are going beyond words and phrases, or words and letters is one of these things. So it's an ultimate understanding that that we use words to communicate. You know, I say I wrote a book, and so you have an idea of what a book is and what it means to write a book. But the actual process and the actual thing is kind of mysterious, and that's what we kind of forget. You know, you hold a bottle in your hands. There's a bottle of water sitting in front of me, and it's made of glass, and it's kind of orange. And we forget how fascinating that is. Like, as a child, when you would pick up something like that, you'd be astounded at it. You know, the weight and the color and the way it felt in your hands and all of this would be all new and amazing to you. But as you grow up and learn the words and learn the concepts, then this stuff stops being quite as amazing, and we forget that actually we are living in a really amazing place. Even when we're doing something mundane or boring, we're actually alive within it, and that itself is incredible. You know, if you actually just step back and go, I'm waiting at a bus stop for a bus, you know, and think about how amazing that is. You know, there's the wind blowing on your face, and there's the chill of the night, and there's so much stuff going on that we forget because we were stuck in our heads thinking, well, if I wasn't here, I could be someplace better.
Yeah, but that's using never true. Your phone.
Yeah.
Do you? I think it's at the beginning of this book where you said you had always had a sense of things being bigger than what the words were anyway. Is that right?
Well, yeah. I mean, I always had a sense that there was something greater, and I can remember being a little kid and feeling that very keenly, and not really having any. I wasn't raised in a religious household, so I didn't have any framework to put that into. I just felt it, and I thought, this is important. This may be the most important thing of all, and I need to understand it thoroughly.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because that, to me, is kind of like the God or the Creator Spirit, is it not?
Well, yeah, I think so. It's this sense of something, something amazing in just life itself. But I don't know, you know, I don't think I'm any sort of a genius, but I feel kind of lucky to have had that, you know, that this feeling or this drive to something. And I think a lot of people miss that.
You have a real attunement for it. I have to take you back to Finland because we still didn't do that.
Oh.
And people are probably scratching their heads going, hello.
I love
what you just said. Don't take that as a dismissal because I think it's really significant.
I'm trying to remember what else I said in the book about Finland.
You were talking about how, let me see, you were talking about reincarnation. You were talking about death, and then this kind of person I would cast in a movie to play the role of a professor of Buddhism at Helsinki University.
That was the guy who thought he was reincarnated from a rabbi.
Oh, that's neat.
He was an interesting character. But, you know, it was just this interesting experience to be part. I was part of what I did in Finland the time before last that I was there was participate in a kind of panel discussion about religion where they had several famous people and me, you know, talking about this stuff, and just seeing how they approached it was quite informative. You know, there was this sort of obsession, especially about this professor at Helsinki University. He had this kind of he only wanted to talk about reincarnation.
Oh, I see.
You know, as soon as he got a chance to bring that topic up, he was off and running, and that's all he talked about. So as far as I could tell, for him, Buddhism and reincarnation were the same thing.
Hmm.
But I feel that that's cheapens Buddhism. I think I think reincarnation is something that's crept into Buddhism and that exists there, but I don't think it's a key part of the story.
Do you think Buddhism is nothingness or is complete lack of suffering and letting go and detachment? What is it?
Well, it's, this word nothingness is problematic because people will make it a contrast, like there's nothing rather than something.
You know, you just said something really powerful, which is, it's so true, isn't it? You put some words freeze reality, this friend told me many years ago.
Yeah.
And then we start leaning up against it, don't we?
Yeah, and that's the problem. You know, Buddhism is this kind of funny thing in that I think it has to reinvent itself every time the general public starts to think it understands what Buddhism is. Then it's the duty of Buddhists to say, no, it's not that. You know, it's like the word mindfulness, which has become very popular, and I would say on some level, Buddhism is about mindfulness. But now that mindfulness has been kind of taken over by the pop culture and made to mean something that the pop culture wants it to mean, I've stopped using the word. I can't stand it anymore. I've gotten into arguments on the internet, where arguments love to live, about mindfulness. But I think once you start to say, well, I understand what mindfulness is about, and then you've already misunderstood mindfulness, because mindfulness is the understanding that you can't understand what mindfulness is. you are mindfulness means this kind of open state where you can be flexible to anything, whereas I think what it's become to mean in the pop culture is something like thinking really hard about stuff. I'm mindful of my place or whatever.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it, that it goes up? Because it seems to me, talking to you, I just get these really big feelings about how it's all way too big to be contained by words, whatever God might be or creator spirit.
Yeah, I think so. It's by definition beyond words. So you can't pin it down. As soon as you start to put a label on it, you've already made a mistake. So
did you bring your guitar to the panel? Maybe that'd be a great tool.
I should have. I used to sing a song called Buddha Was a Good Old Boy. I've kind of retired that song lately. I got tired of it, but I usually got a laugh.
But you also put, at least the stuff that I read, and you've got a good description of you and your life on Wikipedia, which is kind of bringing you into the mundane, isn't it? Into the mundane. But you have a wonderful way of connecting the least likely kinds of things, eh?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's funny because these things seem connected to me, and then when I open my mouth and say something about it, then I realize, oh, other people don't see those connections. And then I feel kind of strange, but I really believe that there's connections between all kinds of things in human endeavor.
Yeah, but I think one of your greatest gifts is making the connection for people so that people can connect, for example, enlightenment porn. I mean, that whole concept of one-upping and the lust for it and the, I'll get it if you, you know, all that, it's quite interesting. Really made me think a lot. That was wonderful. Good for you.
Lust for Enlightenment. Maybe that'll be my next book title.
Well, your book titles are great. What are you writing now? You've finished this one.
I don't know yet. I'm kind of casting around for things. There's, you know, I always try to go for what seems to me to be the most important thing to talk about. And you know, lately I've been thinking about the way the commodification of Buddhism, and how, you know, how it happens. You know, people become famous Buddhist masters, but to become a famous Buddhist master means it pretty much necessitates that you leave behind the things that made you a Buddhist master in the first place. You no longer have time to meditate because you're traveling around the world giving talks.
Marketing your consciousness, yeah?
Yeah, yeah, and it really leads people to a lot of tragic things. So to my mind, it seems like the more famous you are within this realm of spirituality, the less likely you are to have something worthwhile to say. You know, and I wish that weren't the case, but...
Well, where's your cave? Do you live in a cave?
Yeah, I'm working on it. it's an apartment.
Do you love your life?
Yeah, I do. I there are things that sometimes I get frustrated about because, I'm not making good money doing what I do. I went for this kind of funny thing because I was working for a company during the writing of the first three books that I wrote. I had a job, and so I didn't really have to worry about money. Then I lost that job, and I decided to strike out as an independent writer, and that was economically a huge mistake because it's terrible out there. But on the other hand, I like it because it sort of forces me to keep moving, and that's what I want to do. I don't want to rest. And I think if things went too well for me, I might get too lazy, and that wouldn't be good.
Do you write songs as well? I mean, do you write songs and produce music still?
Yeah, I do. The band that I was in when I first encountered Zen, we reformed, and we made a new. You don't even make CDs anymore. There are CDs of it, but I think most people are getting it as a download. Mm-hmm. But we made a new recording, a new album, and I was really excited about that. And I kind of feel like, I know how it goes. People want to read. And I'm really glad that people want to read books about Zen by me, and that's what I'm going to be known for. But, I spend just as much time and effort trying to craft, my part on a Zero Defects album as I do writing a book, even though, a tenth of the number of people, if that, are going to ever hear that music. But it's still important.
Tell me this. This is kind of an odd non sequitur, but you were born in the middle of the 60s, but do you have any sense of the 60s music changing human consciousness on a mass level?
Well, I actually do. It's kind of weird when I think about it, because by the time I was a teenager, the whole 60s thing was over, and we were moving on to spandex and purple hair and that kind of stuff. But what I was listening to, even during the punk rock experience, was 60s rock. I was a big fan of The Who and The Byrds and the Beatles. Of course, you've got to mention them. But so I do feel like that stuff was important, but I also feel like that something went wrong, obviously. That generation was so full of promise, and it was not nothing was delivered, I guess, was the Bob Dylan line, right?
Right.
It all seemed to be going somewhere great, and then it got derailed somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And so I find it interesting, certain people from that generation understand that something went wrong, and certain others still cling to this, notion that, you were moving towards something, but somehow it didn't go there. It went somewhere else. So,
it kind of tipped itself over. Well, I think it's interesting. You went, into punk rock and Zen Buddhism. I mean, it's wonderful. You're really a wonderful expression of, the human consciousness moving through itself, eh?
Well, I try. Thank you.
Well, we have to close off, but I found you particularly delightful and insightful, and you've given me a lot to think about for sure, and hopefully our listeners as well.
So, thank you.
And Brad, I think you've got a couple of things coming up if you'd like to mention them to people.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, on Wednesday I'll be speaking at a place called Upaya Zen Center in Santa Fe. I guess it's just outside of Santa Fe, New Mexico. And then on July 13th in El Paso at the Hope and Anchor, and July 14th at a place in Las Cruces, New Mexico called Center for Spiritual Living.
Well, you're going to have a little
blog.
Fun. Oh, you have a blog.
I have a blog.
How do we find your blog?
It's hardcorezen.info. So we couldn't get .com or .org, so we got .info. So hardcorezen, one word, .info. And I put all my upcoming stuff
on there. And I actually, just today, I'm trying to put together another piece that I hope will be done before the early afternoon.
Well, when I was Googling you in preparation for this discussion, there were people saying, well, always read his blog. It's so interesting. So I guess I'll start doing that a little there.
Well, I'll try to put something good on it then.
You better. Well, I've really appreciated our time together, Brad Warner, and I appreciate all that you're bringing to the planet right now.
Well, thanks. I try.
From your cave there in L.A.?
Yeah, that's right.
Many, many thanks. And to everyone listening, thank you so much for tuning in and brushing up on your understanding of Zen and the God that is not there but is always with you. This is Veronica Entwistle saying, write to us, veronicaentwistle.com, and make comments about Brad Warner or make suggestions for other guests or have a session with me. Many blessings and good night.